chosen one!
Huh?
It was said that you would destroy this and not join them!
Uh-huh.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
That is funny.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Huh? Welcome back. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Promised you I'd give you some information about Google. This is being reported by The Sun, a UK paper. Google allegedly has admitted to listening to conversations recorded by Google Assistant, even without you using the Hey Google trigger. The tech giant made the admission during a closed-door meeting with Indian government officials, according to the report. Sources also told India Today that the company has admitted that its AI assistant at times records audio on your smartphone or smart speaker, even when it hasn't been summoned. So I own an app, an iPhone. So for me, it's, hey, I'll pause so I don't turn on everybody's phone, Siri. That's what wakes up the iPhone. And apparently, hey, Google, that's a public service right there, so I don't wake up all the Android phones by saying that. But that apparently is what wakes it up. So what they're saying is it was admitted in this closed-door meeting, I guess was recorded, that Google admits that some of their employees, they actually just fire up your microphone on your phone and they just listen. Google clarified how the assistant system works in a statement to Android Authority. In standby mode, the device processes short snippets of audio for a few seconds to detect an activation, like when you say, hey, Google. If no activation is detected, then those audio snippets won't be sent or saved to Google. The statement also noted that when the assistant detects its wake word, the recording can include a few seconds before you activate your assistant to catch your request at the right time. Well, how can it activate it before you request it if you haven't requested it yet? That's my question. Google has previously admitted that employees do listen to short recordings to improve language comprehension in its product. Cyrus, if Google is listening at odd moments to your phone, just rest assured in knowing that they're only doing it. The employees are only listening to improve language comprehension in its products.
Oh, in that case, I mean, listen away. What
possible harm could there be?
Well, why wouldn't Google be listening? I mean, honestly, Siri's listening. Our TVs are watching us. Is anyone surprised by this?
You know, I'm not surprised, but I don't like it.
No, same. No. Yep, same. Yeah. I don't like it either. I'm not condoning it. It's just right. One thing
I've said before, when I go to confession, the sacrament of confession, I never, ever, ever, ever take my cell phone in there with me. It's off and it's in my car. Locked, by the way. Because, I mean...
And let's hope the priest has done the same thing.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe not. But, I mean, it's just a little protective measure, and I don't know that I'm particularly of interest to anybody, but let's say that somebody was interested and had found a way to hack into my phone. The last thing I want them is listening when I go to confession or listening when I'm having a private conversation with somebody. So, I mean, if you see pictures of Jeff Zuckerberg and some of the other big guys in the tech industry, it's not uncommon to see pictures, like if they're in their office or something, where the cameras and the microphones on their laptops are covered with tape. They're doing it because they know better. So back to this. These language experts, as part of their work, they develop speech technology for more languages. And David Monsees, product manager for Google Search, he says, we partner with language experts around the world who understand the nuances and accents of a specific language. They review and transcribe a small set of queries to help us better understand those languages. This is a critical part of the process of building speech technology, and it's necessary to create products like the Google Assistant. So, Cyrus, it's necessary that they listen to your conversations. That's all. I mean, to help them do a better job, they need to listen in on what you're saying at the kitchen table.
Yeah,
or wherever.
That's right.
Yeah, or wherever. Now, to its credit, Google has since changed its policies requiring Home or Nest users to opt into having voice searches recorded in the first place in response to the backlash. If you are unsure whether you have opted in or out, or if you're just curious to know what Google has recorded about you, that would be fun or scary. There are some ways to check. So in this article, it gives you how to check what Google has recorded of you. Could be your phone, could be one of these devices in your home. It also gives you steps to how to turn off the option for them to do that. And I think it's, you know, word to the wise, because chances are you probably would like to keep your private things private. And the Google employees don't need to know that, if you ask me. It's and so you'll find that article.
Sorry. Yeah, you tell people where they can find the article.
Why don't you tell them this time?
I don't have it in front of me.
You were anxious to say it. No,
well,
I'll tell
no, them. It just made me think of another story that you had me do some research on, where it's like 20% of people think that there's microchips in the vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah.
Let's
just
talk about that.
It's ridiculous. Like, first of all, a microchip is way too large to fit through, to be invisible and fit through the head of a needle. I mean, and then have a transmitter that transmits information to wherever. And that's, but all at the same time, we're all carrying around these devices and looking into these screens and watching television at home that's watching us.
Yeah.
And we're concerned. It's just a weird, it's a weird thing to be scared about.
I'm glad you brought that up. So here is the information about that. And this is from the Jerusalem Post. 20% of Americans believe microchips are inside the COVID-19 vaccines. Now, you know that I've spoken on this topic before, and I've said I absolutely do not believe that. I don't accept that view. There's no reason to accept it in my reading and research. But in any case, here's how it's being reported in the Jerusalem Post. Some 20% of Americans believe in the conspiracy theory that microchips have been implanted inside COVID-19 vaccines that millions of people have already taken worldwide, according to a study by YouGov, Y-O-U-G-O-V, and The Economist. These are studies that were conducted last week. Despite a lack of evidence to support such a claim, the poll concluded overall that 15% of Americans said this conspiracy theory was, quote, probably true, while another 5% said it was definitely true. Now, that's small. I mean, I'm thankful that the vast majority of Americans don't buy into this, but some do. The same poll concluded that 27% of people aged 30 to 44 support this theory, 8% of Biden voters and 29% of Trump voters believed it. Some 14% of Democratic voters and 32% of Republican voters also shared the same sentiment. Misinformation regarding COVID-19 has been a controversial topic in the last year. We talked a little bit about that earlier today, about how they're flagging things on people's Facebook pages if they think it's misinformation. So it's interesting. Other conspiracy theorists have targeted Bill and Melinda Gates, saying that they have been behind the so-called plot. In response, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation told the BBC that it's completely false. In January, upon rumors saying that COVID-19 vaccines cause infertility or contain products derived from pork, multiple Jewish doctors warned against the conspiracy, saying that there's absolutely no evidence to this claim. So, yeah, I don't believe there are microchips in there.
It cannot possibly be 20% of Americans really believe that.
According to this survey,
that's,
you know, I mean, unless the survey is faulty,
right?
But anyway,
yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Let's go to Susan now in Northern New Jersey. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Patrick. I was just listening to you about going to confession without your cell phone, and I was wondering, mm-hmm. when I go to confession, should I be asking the priest, is your cell phone on? Do you have a cell phone?
Bless me, Father,
you?
For I have sinned. Is your cell phone on?
Yeah. This confession may be monitored for quality assurance.
Let's hope not. Yeah. Well, that's a funny take on it, but obviously it's a serious topic with regard to how easy it is now using technology to eavesdrop on people's conversations and to activate the camera or the microphone on somebody's phone. It's a topic we've talked about on the program off and on over the years. The technology is certainly there. People have the ability, if they've got the money and they know where to get the technology, they can do it. I did a story, Susan, and this is, you know, not related to confession per se, but I did a story on a Russian dissident who was arrested by the FBI, and it took him forever to get his name cleared. But the hostile powers in Russia, from all the way over there, he was actually living, I believe it was in New York, but he was a Russian dissident in living in exile. They remotely planted child pornography on his computer. And then they tipped off the police. The police came, they raided his house, and he's like, what are you talking about? So they did a forensic study on his computer, and they found it. And one thing led to another. Eventually, he was able to prove that it was planted remotely on his computer. I mean, talk about scary. And the ability to destroy somebody's life that way. It's truly mind-boggling what our capabilities are now technologically, right?
Wow. I mean, confession, and I mean, the vulnerability is so there.
There are times, Susan, and I do appreciate your phone call. Thank you. There are times when I do think there's a lot of wisdom in people saying, nope, I don't have a smartphone, I've got a flip phone. Or nope, I don't have a computer. I know that sounds crazy. It's like saying, no, I don't have electricity, or no, I don't have running water. It sounds that crazy to the modern mind, but there is something there, because if you limit what kind of technology you have, you also limit the vulnerability that you have for people who might want to cause you harm for some reason. Thank you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Stella in Los Angeles. Hi, Stella.
I think, well, first I want to say, I think what that lady was saying, you got to evolve or dissolve. You got to start evolving with this. I think that's what she was saying. But anyways,
right.
Enough about
I think she was.
That topic.
Which side are you on? Are you on the evolve side or the dissolve side?
I have no comment, I guess. No, I live in a no pronoun zone.
Okay, very good.
I'm calling this morning to follow up on, I called a few days earlier to ask about a book for catechism, and you suggested Baltimore.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you were recommending that, you said you don't think that confirmation should be like a carrot on a stick. You don't think it should be like a reward for kids for coming out to Sunday school.
Yeah.
And then I also spoke with another friend who used to live in Nevada, and he said that just like my church, he also had to go to Sunday school for 2 years before he could get confirmed. And so I always thought that was the norm, but you made it seem like that's not the norm. And I was wondering how other parishes do it and how we can maybe
good
change
question
that program.
Well, it certainly was never the norm as a standard thing until maybe let's say the 70s. So I was confirmed, I think it was in 72 or 73, and when I was confirmed, it was understood that you would be going to CCD classes if you didn't go to a Catholic school. And since I went to a Catholic school and I got CCD taught, I received my Catholic education in school because I was going to a Catholic school. It's long ago enough that I don't remember all the specifics, but I don't remember ever there being a quid pro quo. If you don't go to these classes, then you can't be confirmed. It was just understood that you needed to be prepared. And I think that's good. I think we should prepare the young people as best we can in preparation for that. But it's not, strictly speaking, that necessary if they're going to be confirmed at a younger age. And some dioceses now, I think, are making the smart move in going back to the earlier tradition of the church and giving the children the sacrament of confirmation at an earlier age, and thus helping to avoid this idea that the kids that wind up getting, and that is that, well, this is like a bar mitzvah or something, and it's a rite of passage, and I get this as a prize if I've done these things or if I've checked these boxes, then I get that. And one of the things that leads me to the opinion that I hold on this issue, Stella, is because historically, in my experience, when confirmation takes place, usually that's when the kids are out of there. It's like, okay, I'm done. I got my confirmation, and you see a huge drop-off in mass attendance, for example. You see a huge drop-off in any kind of formal study of the faith. They just sort of check out. And I've seen it all over the place, all over the country. So I'm not saying necessarily that delaying confirmation until 16 or 17 years of age causes that, or that giving them the impression that this is the prize they get at the end of their 2-year thing is the cause of that. But I think it contributes in some way to that mindset. And then you see the terrible situation where the kids just stop going at that point. Like, okay, I got my I got my confirmation. Now I'm done and on to other things. So historically, the sacrament would be given to the children when they were sufficiently prepared. And it doesn't take 2 years to prepare for the sacrament of confirmation, please. I mean, you can prepare a child for the sacrament of confirmation over the space of an hour or two. It doesn't have to be elongated that way. And from a pastoral standpoint, I don't think that it's particularly a good thing to do that. So anyway, those are my thoughts on it. I think it's probably more that way institutionally in parishes around the country. I think most parishes, if I had to guess, and I've traveled quite a bit in the last 35 years or so and visited many parishes. I wasn't there to inspect their confirmation preparation, but anecdotally at least, I think probably more parishes than not are following the model that you're used to, if I had to guess.
Well, then now I have another follow-up question because Bishop Barron mentioned something about we don't want to dumb down our catechism classes and, you know, and things like that. And if our students, if like some of them go to Catholic schools and some of them go to public schools, mm-hmm. then the Catholic school kids know so much more than the public school kids. And it's like they're bored out of their minds. And the other, and it's hard to find a difficulty level when we have a mixed group of kids. And mm-hmm. I looked at, and I haven't really had a chance to look at the table of contents for Baltimore, but there's the problem of, like, I don't know, that makes me think maybe if it can, we can prepare a student in like a few hours, maybe we can do like, I don't know, a quiz at the end of the semester mm-hmm. or, but that's also giving them a reward too.
True. And I mean, you're dealing here with pedagogy and I'm not a teacher by trade or by training, I guess, but I think just as a parent and as somebody who's been deeply involved in catechetics for years, my point was not that we want to minimize or take shortcuts or to dumb down, to use your phrase. I'm not suggesting that at all. In fact, I would argue we want our children to be as prepared as possible. But strictly speaking, it doesn't require 2 years of preparation to receive the sacrament of confirmation. And if the pedagogy is adequate and if it's done properly, then it can be done in a much shorter time frame. But this is a decision that's beyond my control. This is the decision, and rightfully so, of the pastor, of the bishop. They're the ones who decide such things, not me. All I'm doing is offering maybe a somewhat different way of looking at it. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. I hope that's helpful. Did you by chance get a copy of the Baltimore Catechism yet?
I didn't, not yet. I looked it up, mm-hmm. and it really was like $5. I thought you were mm-hmm. exaggerating, but it is super cheap. But I also saw like in the suggested search questions, things like, is Baltimore Catechism outdated and things like that. But mm-hmm. I tried not to pay attention to it.
That's okay. There is a school of thought out there of people who disdain the Baltimore Catechism. They say that it's retrograde, it's, you know, behind the times. I've heard all the arguments against it, but I'll tell you what, there's a lot of value in this book because it presents the Catholic faith not only in a way that's solid and accurate and comprehensive, but also it's interesting. Just the pictures alone are interesting. I remember when I was in sixth, seventh grade, and we had the Baltimore Catechism, I would just study this. I would look at the pictures and I would read the questions and answers. And it was just extremely interesting to me. And I've seen the same thing with my kids. I saw it with my grandkids. I think it's a human nature kind of thing. You want to present it in a way that will be interesting. So I'm a big fan of the Baltimore Catechism, and Jimmy Crack Corn and I don't care if people say that it's outdated. It's effective. And that's what I think we need a lot of nowadays, if you ask me. It's not the only tool in the toolbox, but I think it's a good one to use and to have. Thank you. Let's see if we can get quickly to Sam in Athens, Georgia. Sam, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you. For the people.
Automatic for the people.
Yes. Have a question, Patrick, about the New Testament where demons in a house are referred to, like when you sweep one out, then that makes room for seven more worse ones to come in. What does that mean?
Well, Jesus, if it's the one I'm thinking of, Jesus talks about a man who has a demon because he repents and the demon is gone. And then the demon comes back to find the house swept. And that's an analogy for the soul. It's cleaned up now. So he goes back. And the understanding of that I have is that the demon realizes that he by himself cannot come back in. So he goes and he gets the other demons. He gets seven more, I guess. And he comes back so that strength in numbers, he'll be in a position to overpower that person and then come back in. So I've always understood it to mean that it was an intensification of the attack by the evil one. Now, is that getting to the heart of your question?
It is. I was confused about the house analogy, I guess.
Yeah, I understand that to be Jesus' way of talking about the soul, that the soul is swept and clean. It's no longer disordered. It's no longer in chaos as it once was. Jesus uses a similar analogy. He says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock, and whoever opens, I will come in and dine with him, have supper with him." So he uses that kind of house analogy. You are in your house. Jesus is at the door knocking. And when you open the door of your soul, you receive him into your house, into your living room. It's kind of a homey analogy that Jesus uses, isn't it?
It is. It is. But it makes sense now. When more demons attack, is he referring to literally demons or just evil in general?
I would say literally for sure, but also the way in which demonic influence can play out through the world. We're warned in the Bible, as you know, Sam, about the world, the flesh, and the devil. So there are three things, one of which is actually demonic, but the other two can easily, you know, can easily cooperate with demonic influence. So, hey, Sam, this one's for you. In Athens, Georgia, automatic for the people. Great talking to you. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
I don't know if you caught this, but the LA County Sheriff has said he's not going to enforce the new indoor mask mandate. Man, oh man, oh man, oh man. Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva announced just a couple days ago that he will not enforce new indoor mask mandates set to be reinstated in the country's most populous county, that's LA County. County health officials decided that the indoor mask mandate would apply regardless of a person's vaccination status. The mandate was announced on Thursday of last week. It took effect on Saturday. Villanueva said in a statement, "Forcing the vaccinated and those who already contracted COVID-19 to wear masks indoors is not backed by science, and it contradicts the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health has authority to enforce the order, but the underfunded, defunded Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department will not expend our limited resources and instead ask for voluntary compliance. We encourage the Department of Public Health to work collaboratively with the Board of Supervisors and law enforcement to establish mandates that are both achievable and supportable by science." So that's happening. Interesting. Well, I wonder how the Board of Supervisors will handle that. So we'll get a link to that story posted for you. There's more to it than that, but that gives you a flavor for what's going on right now. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Lyndhurst, New Jersey, and talk to Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good morning. I just have a question, because I was listening to everything you were playing before about education, what teachers were saying, and I myself am a teacher. I actually teach Latin and classical humanities, and I'm a relatively new teacher, and I have to say, all this rhetoric makes me pretty nervous, because a lot of times when people talk about racist education and colonialism in education, Latin might be overlooked unless it's present, and then it almost seems as though it becomes an immediate target. And me, I see myself as doing God's work by teaching Latin, since it's the language anointed by the blood of Christ on the crucifix, and it's the language of the Roman Catholic Church. So I guess I just want your opinion on Latin in education and how perhaps someone like me could handle the tide of, I guess you could say, progressive influence in the field of education.
Mm-hmm. Bonum est. I'll start with that. I took two or three years of Latin in high school? It was at least two. It might have been three in high school. And then I took another year in my undergraduate, and then I took another 2 years in graduate school. So I'm a grateful recipient for the years that I've had of studying Latin. And I can only imagine what satisfaction it brings you to teach Latin to kids. It's one way to help them think more clearly, because, as you know, Latin is a very inflected language, unlike, say, English. So it helps order the mind to understand all the aspects of how Latin works. So I've benefited greatly from it, and I encourage parents to have their children in some way or another learn at least some Latin. Now, how is that going to be for you, by way of, does that mean you're going to have a target on your back? I don't think so. Because one of the things you got going for you, Frank, is that Latin, being a dead language, it's not susceptible to the modifications that a living language goes through. And you can't force ideologies on a dead language. It is what it is, as you know. So maybe that will give you a bit of protection there, because there's not much they can do with it. There's not much they can do with Latin. I used to think the same thing about math, but they're running roughshod over math as well and trying to turn math into some sort of racist construct. I don't understand how they get to that point, but I have a feeling they'll probably leave the Latinists like yourself alone, at least in terms of trying to monkey with your curriculum. I don't know what they could do with it, honestly.
That's my hope. But then also keeping in mind the recent motu proprio and looking at, because in New Jersey, Latin is thriving in private schools, which I work in the Catholic school. Mm-hmm. But there's a big movement in the progressive section of education around here to actually eliminate it from the curriculum.
I see.
Claiming that,
okay.
Like, I'm not sure if Princeton, New Jersey, this was actually a few, in Princeton University, the classics department eliminated Latin and Greek as a requirement.
I saw that.
Classics major because.
Yeah, I actually reported on that on the show, that of all, it's the most ridiculous thing to get a degree in classics, which requires at least a reading knowledge of Latin and Greek. They're saying, well, you don't have to learn Latin or Greek, but we'll still give you a classics degree. It makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it's absurd. But it just makes me think that an elimination of the language, or a push to eliminate it where it's present, might happen. And I don't know. I guess also the Pope's recent motu proprio, although not eliminating Latin in the masses, but I myself go to a Novus Ordo church, but it kind of puts a weird light on Latin from a Catholic viewpoint, I feel like. And I guess because of that, it just raises my awareness a little bit. And I figured, I mean, I've been listening to you my whole life. I'm 23, so I figured to get your opinion on this.
Way to make me feel old. No, that's okay, though. I'm glad to know that you did. Well, hang in there. You know, one thing to think about is if it goes by the way in terms of, let's say, academia not wanting to hang on to Latin, what a shame that would be. You're in a perfect position to set yourself up as a highly paid tutor of Latin. And the parents who recognize the value of Latin may seek you out to tutor their kids in a language that they can't learn at their local university or their local high school. So that may wind up redounding to your benefit.
I suppose so. Well, thank you very much, and for sharing your opinion with me. Pax tibi, Dominus vobiscum.
Thank you very much. Et cum spiritu tuo, pax tibi. Thank you very much, Frank. It's nice to dust off some of my Latin. One thing's for sure, the old saying is use it or lose it. I try to keep up with my language studies. I know it may sound eccentric, but I try to keep up with my language studies every single day in different languages as well, because that old saying I found to be true. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. And I find a lot of value in having studied foreign languages. It served me well, and I think has really helped me to appreciate other things that are not necessarily language-based, but they have a bearing on that. So parents, teach your kids languages. Let's go to Veronica now in Belton, Texas. Hi, Veronica. Where in Texas is Belton exactly?
Over by Fort Hood.
Okay.
Okay. The base.
Yeah. So okay. How many of you have service?
I'm wondering if it would be okay to attend a sweat lodge. My friend of mine invited me to a ceremony for, he wants to do a little ceremony for the soul of my brother.
Mm-hmm.
I told him okay, but then I was told not to attend because it's that spirit.
What is the ceremony entail? That might help me answer the question. Is it like a memorial ceremony?
I have no idea. Well, yes, a memorial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I've never gone to a sweat lodge ceremony, so I don't have any, you know, personal knowledge about it. I only know what I think I know about it. It's probably not that much. But if it's not a ceremony that is like worshiping a god or offering a sacrifice, and I know that that doesn't go on at a sweat lodge ceremony, at least I know that much, then I don't think there would be harm in it per se. But if it were like overtly a religious ceremony that was worshiping a god, small g, or if it was invoking spirits or something like that, then I would stay away from it. But if it was more a matter of prayer and meditation and you're going to get purified by sweating out whatever, I wouldn't find that problematic. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the Jesuit missionaries from France who came to what is now New York State and Ontario, Canada, they themselves, as part of their mission to the native peoples, they would participate in some of these things. Now, if they recognized that this was invoking a god or if it was doing something that would be contrary to the faith, they would never participate in that. But by way of learning the culture of the people, they learned their languages, they would live among them, they would participate in the things that they did, including some of their rituals. So I see there, in their example, a kind of open door for something like that if it doesn't involve worship or invoking of gods or spirits or something like that. I think there's some room there by way of what we see from the Jesuit missionaries all those years ago. But it would require more investigation to find out, well, what exactly does this ceremony involve? And then once you know that, then you could make a better decision. But if it's something mild and it's simply, hey, we're going to get together and meditate on peace or think about how we can be better people and we're going to sweat a lot and we're going to beat on a drum and sing hymns or something, I don't think that's really a problem personally.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah, so do a little more homework. And then, but my strong encouragement would be if you detect that it will be something religious and incompatible with the faith, then I would not participate. That'd be my advice. Thank you, Veronica. Let's go now to Henry in Chicago. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Patrick. My question is it possible to celebrate sacramental marriage without being married under civil law?
Yes, and let's take the case of a couple that is living in a very remote place. Let's say two Catholics, and they live in a very remote third world area. And not only is there no civil infrastructure, there's no courtroom or judge or anything like that. There's also no priest who's available much of the time. The church foresees scenarios like that and says that a couple has the right to marry. As long as they're free to marry, they have the right to marriage, and they can confer upon each other the sacrament of holy matrimony under circumstances like that. Because otherwise what would happen is if you had to have an officiant, say a priest or a deacon, for example, but they couldn't get there for a year or more, well, then you'd be expecting the impossible. You'd be expecting people to not be able to get married, and that's not good. So the church recognizes that in some circumstances you can do this, but the norm would be to cooperate with the laws of the land. And if the law requires that you have a civil marriage or a civil license, and like in Mexico, for example, you have to do that, and then you can get married in the church. In the United States, as I understand it, the church recognizes, the civil authority recognizes the marriage in a church. So let's say the nuptial mass and the witness of the priest is sufficient in the eyes of the government to suffice. So there doesn't have to be a separate civil marriage alongside the marriage that takes place in a Catholic church. That's accepted as, you know, as sufficient for that. Is that getting to the heart of your question?
Halfway. Okay. So I'm not talking about, you know, some far off land where we don't have a lot of civil authority or mm-hmm. even the, you know, the presence of the church. I'm talking about the U.S. And specific to this case, we have a widow who has widow's benefits, doesn't want to lose them. It's an older couple. The gentleman was married in the church, has annulment completed. And so, you know, there's this concern. They want to keep their legal and financial assets separate, but they're both Catholic and they're in love and they right. want to have a sacramental marriage.
I understand the question now. Okay, that makes sense. Well, I believe, and I'm not having any legal background, I can't say with certitude, but I believe that if they were married in the church, so let's say they got married at St. Miscellaneous Parish, when that wedding license is signed by the priest afterward, that gets registered with the state. I don't think that the parish priest is going to say, yes, I'll marry you, but I'm not going to report it. I'm not going to fill out the requisite paperwork. I don't think that's would likely happen. So it may be that they have to make a decision to give up one or the other, either the benefits or, you know, they get married and they give up the benefits, or they keep the benefits and they don't get married. And it's not a very appealing choice, but that's my understanding of how it would go. You'd have to ask the pastor, okay. though. He would know for sure.
Okay. All right. Very good. Yeah. Patrick, thank All you right, very much.
Henry. You're most welcome, Henry. Thank you. Yeah. Those are difficult situations, no doubt. All right, how about a break? And then we'll come right back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. If you missed any part of the show, you can always hear everything by firing up the Relevant Radio app or by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick and listen to everything as it's archived there. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Let's go!
Welcome back, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. To the phones, let's go to Mary Jane in San Carlos, California. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, Patrick. I'm so pleased to talk to you. You
Thank
are
you.
Such a dear person and a formidable theologian. But today I want to ask you, how do we block a smart TV from being able to watch us?
Well, great question. I think that you can take a piece of, for example, like black electrician's tape, and if you look closely at the front, you'll see where probably in the center there would be a sensor of some sort, and that may affect your remote control. But then again, it may not. But if you can see where there may be a camera, it'd probably be pretty small, then you could just cover that up. And if you want to try, if you see a sensor there and just cover it up and then test your remote control, then you'll find out whether or not that's going to mess up the remote control. But if it's a smart TV that has a camera, almost certainly it'll be on the front, either at the top or the bottom and in the center. That's where I would
That's excellent. That helps me a lot. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If you don't have Wi-Fi in your home, would someone be able to hack you? And I do not have Wi-Fi.
Okay. Is your television connected to, let's say, a cable, like a coax cable that comes in from the street that feeds it with the service?
Yes, Comcast.
Comcast. Okay, so
connected to a box.
Okay. Chances are there is some internet connectivity that's coming through that wire. Now, it may not be turned on for you if you don't have that service. If you're not buying internet as part of your monthly package, it may not be turned on. But at least theoretically, it would have the capability of doing that. And my question would then be, let's say it's a late model television that's a smart television, meaning that it can phone home. It may not require that you have the service that you're paying for internet in your home. It may be designed so that it can still ride the wire and provide the information back to the manufacturer that way. I just don't know for sure. I'd have to read the manual and see. But if you wanted to block it, I could just, you know, suggest you use black electrician's tape.
That's excellent. I thank you so much. That helps.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. How long have you been listening to Relevant Radio, Mary Jane?
Well, about 7 years. And believe me, when I found you, I only listened to other radio stations that were Christian. Mm-hmm. And I was born and raised and baptized in the Lutheran Church. And I have loved God all my life. But I tell you, I love and really mostly listen all day and evening to Relevant Radio. You are so informative and helpful, and it's very comforting.
That makes me so happy to hear that, Mary Jane. I'm glad we can keep you company.
Yes, yes. At 72, I'll be 72 in September, I really am considering changing to the Catholic Church just from listening to you and the others who I listen to on Relevant Radio.
That is so wonderful. Well, we will welcome you with open arms, Mary Jane. When the day comes, just know that we and so many other people who are listening to you right now will be overjoyed and will welcome you with open arms. If there's anything that we can do to answer questions or anything like that, please never hesitate to call in, okay?
Well, I do have a question about the Eucharist.
Okay.
We never called it the Eucharist in the Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the Eucharist something different than just wine?
Great question. Well, which synod of the Lutheran Church do you belong to, Mary Jane?
The Missouri Synod.
Missouri Synod, okay. So in the Missouri Synod, as with some others that I understand, they would refer to it most likely as communion. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So in the Missouri Synod, they would view the communion service as a memorial that is symbolic of what the Lord did at the Last Supper, and the bread and the wine that are given at communion are symbols. They don't believe, as Catholics do, that they are more than just symbols. So in the Catholic Church at Mass, the priest, being ordained by the bishop, has the power, has the ability to change the bread and the wine into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. We call this transubstantiation, as you probably know. And the outward characteristics of the bread and the wine remain, however. So what tasted like bread and looked like bread, if you were to feel the texture of it, it would feel like a wafer of bread. All of those external characteristics remain. Same would be with the wine. So the flavor of the wine, the color, all of those properties of the wine remain. But the reality of the bread and the wine are gone now, and it's replaced by the glorious resurrected Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity under the appearances of bread and wine. So that's the distinction there. So in the Lutheran communion service, they don't believe, And they're right in not believing it. They don't believe that this is anything more than just bread and wine. There are some Lutherans who hold a higher view, and they would call it maybe consubstantiation, or impanation is another term for it, where the bread and the wine are there, but God or Jesus is also there in a certain sense. But nowadays, most Lutherans don't hold that view. Whereas in the Catholic Church at Mass, the priest actually does cause that change to happen. It's really God who causes the change, but he's doing it through the ministry of the priest. So that would be the distinction at a broad level. And the Eucharist is the term that the Catholic Church uses to describe both the bread and the wine that are used at Mass. So the Eucharistic bread and the Eucharistic wine. We also call it the precious blood. It's fascinating, isn't it?
I see. That's very instructive. Thank you, Patrick.
You're most welcome. And if you're a reader and you'd like to delve deeper into it, there's a very good book called The Hidden Manna. And it's by Father James O'Connor. It's a book that will explain the Eucharist. He even has a section there talking about the differences between the Lutheran view of communion and the Catholic teaching on the Mass. It's not polemical. He's not getting into fights or arguments or anything. It's just a really helpful book that will explain it in greater detail from the Bible and such. So I hope that's helpful
James
to you, Mary
O'Connor,
Jane.
James O'Connor, and the title again?
Is called The Hidden Manna, M-A-N-N-A.
Okay, The Hidden Manna. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
I will look for that book.
I hope you enjoy it, and I sure enjoyed chatting with you. What a great way to get close to the end of the show today. Thank you. Well, let's see. We have some other phone calls we can get to. I'm just waiting to see if they... It doesn't look like some of them are quite ready to go yet. So I want to share with you a few other items that I've got. You've seen Britney Spears in the news lately a lot with her problem with her father and the conservatorship. And one of the things I was distressed to learn, I didn't know about this until fairly recently, is that she says that one of the constrictions or constraints that have been placed on her by the court and by her father is that she's forced to wear an IUD. She's forced to have an intrauterine device, which is obviously a form of birth control. And she doesn't want to have it. She doesn't believe that she needs it. She would like to get married and have a family. And of course, she's not permitted to make this decision for herself. And one of the deeply troubling things about that is that the IUD is an irritant in the womb. And what it does is it would prevent the implantation of a fertilized ovum. So if there is a conception that takes place, then the fertilized ovum, the zygote, the human being, it would attach to the lining of the uterus, and the IUD would prevent that from happening. So one can only imagine that every time there would be a conception, unbeknownst to the mother, that would result in an abortion, effectively. So that's one of the disturbing aspects of her story. And in The Sun, they have an article about Mel Gibson, the actor and director, how he said with regard to Britney Spears that Christianity would save her. And I found that very interesting, because Mel Gibson himself is not, let's say, a paragon of Christianity and what it means to be a Christian. But his point is correct, even though he himself may not be living up to that standard. So the article says in 2008, the world watched as pop princess Britney went through a devastating breakdown. Extreme partying, reports of prescription drug abuse, violent outbursts prompted a court to hand over control of her life to her dad. During the period of personal turmoil, a host of random names reached out to offer her support, including Mel Gibson. Speaking for the first time about Britney's most troubled years, Mel Gibson said in an interview, or she said rather in an interview, I remember Mel Gibson was one of them. And her father, too. And her friends and others talk about people who reached out to her. One of her friends, his name is Sean Phillip. He says Mel Gibson told her that Christianity would save her and that to turn back to God. He says it was all quite surreal. Now, my question is, why is that surreal? How weird it is that we've gotten to a point in society where a Christian, even not necessarily a particularly good Christian, is telling somebody else that Christianity will save you, Jesus will save you, and turn back to God and your life can become better. How is that surreal? Fans recently listened as she described the arrangement that she has with this conservatorship and how it's ruining her life. And I wonder to what extent she took Mel Gibson's advice seriously. I hope she did, because the poor thing, she just seems completely out of sorts, is maybe the only way I can describe it, in her personal life, her emotional life, all the ways in which she's just having so many problems that I do believe that Mel Gibson is right, that the one and only ultimate solution for her and her personal happiness is going to be to rediscover. I don't know if she ever was Catholic or if she ever was even generically Christian at some point, but Mel Gibson was right. And maybe in your kindness, you can remember to pray for this young woman and ask that the Lord will give her the graces that she needs, not only to get out of this terrible situation, but to get her life back on track. Well, until tomorrow, I'll pray for you as I always do every day. Please pray for me. God bless you.